From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the 1920s, Muncie, Indiana, was so typical an American town that two sociologists, Robert and Helen Lind, famously named it Middletown, USA. Back then, the Linds saw an old agrarian community adrift in a new industrial age. Today, we're now told, Muncie, Indiana is feeling adrift again. A big, sharp story in the National Journal describes a town suffering not only from a down economy, but from a sense that across the board, the institutions that once supported it have now failed it. That its banks, schools, mainline churches, city hall are not up to the challenges of this century. It's a tough picture from the heart of the country. And once again, it may apply all over. This hour on Point, Middletown, USA, in trouble. You can join the conversation. Does Muncie, Indiana sound like your town these days? Are we in need of an overhaul? Is it happening? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Special welcome today to our listeners in Muncie on Indiana Public Radio. It must seem a mixed blessing sometimes to be called out as Middletown, USA. The big piece of reporting that's put Muncie back in the news and provoked a lot of talk is from the National Journal. Its headline is, "In Nothing We Trust," and it is a pretty sobering read. You can see it at our website, onpointradio.org. Its authors now join us. Ron Fournier is editor-in-chief of the National Journal, joins us from Washington. Ron, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
And Sophie Quinton is with us. She covers the White House and political news for the National Journal. Sophie, thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Ron, Sophie, we know there's a lot of history here when it comes to poking and prodding at Muncie, Indiana. And you've got some great anecdote here. But, you know, anecdote can sometimes illuminate and sometimes deceive. So let's hold off on that for just a second. But holy smokes, you've got a big thesis here that this is a place you write where people have lost their faith in their institutions, government, politics, corporations, the media, organized religion, organized labor, banks, businesses, other mainstays of a healthy society are failing. Ron, you're describing a town, a small city, that just could not be more disillusioned. Justify that headline for us, "In Nothing We Trust."
Well, I think it applies. I think your listeners will probably agree applies not just to Muncie. Muncie's a story of America. We started with just the facts, with just the data that shows poll after poll, especially over the last 20, 30 years, a steep decline in our faith in our institutions. All the institutions you mentioned, plus many more, including, by the way, media. And Muncie just seemed like the smart place to go to try to put a human face on it, try to figure out what the causes and the effects and maybe even possible solutions to this once a century problem.
You can't trust anything anymore. You've got your lead character here, Johnny Whitmire, in Muncie saying, Sophie, what was Johnny's experience? It may stand up. If Muncie stands for the country, he may stand for at least some of Muncie. Maybe we'll hear from them in this hour. 800-423-8255. Tell us Johnny's story, Sophie, is kind of illustrative of how people can lose their faith in just about everything.
I'm actually going to pass this one back over to Ron, as he is the one who actually spoke to Johnny for this piece.
Oh, good, good. Ron, give it to us.
Yeah, I bumped into Johnny at a very nondescript city hall meeting. It was one of the lower tier of the board meetings. There's very few people there, mainly city employees. Very few members of the public came to this public meeting. And Johnny was there. It was, I think, the third item on the agenda. It was listed as weed appeal. He was there to appeal a $300 citation he'd gotten for high weeds on his property. And he explained to the board that actually it wasn't his property anymore, that he had lost it to the bank. And the board president said, "Well, actually, it's still in your name. That's something the mortgage company likes to do to avoid liability." And Johnny, don't want to give away the ending here, but it was interesting to watch Johnny try to navigate the generally a city government that doesn't listen. Actually, I will give it away. At the end of the day, they did help him out. And
but it's the train of events that led him to this moment of kind of, "I can't count on anything more" feeling. That's
exactly.
Really interesting here. Give us that train.
Yeah, well, it started about a year ago. His wife lost her job. She had worked for the state government in the budget cuts that Mitch Daniels put in place to save the state money and to bring the deficit into order in Indiana. She lost her job. They applied for a home modification loan through the Obama administration program. They got a lower mortgage rate through that program. And like millions of other people in the country, they found out 3 months later that without any warning, that the original rate was going to be, mortgage rate was going to be reimposed. By then, he had lost his job. And the mortgage company had imposed, in addition to raising the rate back up, it imposed an $1,800 fee. He couldn't afford the fee. He couldn't afford the higher mortgage rate. So he filed for bankruptcy, left his keys on the table for the bank to take away, and moved into a trailer. Flash forward a year later, he's living with his grandson and his wife. He's helping to raise his grandson in a trailer, and he gets this note from the city council saying, from the city government saying, you have $100 or $300 fine for weeds in your yard. So Johnny goes to the board and says, you know, I can't pay this, but I would like to keep cutting the lawn in the hopes that I'll get the property back. I would like to buy it back from the bank. So here's a guy who was let down by his mortgage company, let down by the federal government, let down by the state government, and then salt in the wounds, he gets this note from City Hall. So he was, you're right, it's an anecdote, but he's very really nicely illustrated the problem that a lot of Americans feel. Johnny loves his country. He voted for President Obama. He might vote for him again. He's disappointed in the president. He showed up at the City Hall meeting, so he's not totally turned away from government. But he's very disillusioned. He just feels like, you know, the world has turned against me, and there's nobody out there trying to help good, hardworking people like me.
He says, I was middle class for 10 years, but it's done. I lost my home, live in a trailer because of a mortgage company and an incompetent government. So if you pull the lens on back from there and to some pretty big conclusions here, and I know this is a year-long effort the National Journal is involved in to look at what's going on with the country. It's a good time for that. Everybody's got the sense that we need to really pay attention here. But you and Wright, we've got kind of in Muncie and beyond an existential problem. With few notable exceptions, the nation's one-time social pillars are ill-equipped for the 21st century, and they're failing to adapt quickly enough for a population buffeted by wrenching economic, technological, and demographic change. So if you pull the lens on back with this, it's not just banks and City Hall where you found disillusionment in Muncie.
That's right, Tom. We looked at the religious institutions in town. We looked at the school system in town, and we also looked at City Hall. And what we found when we looked at those institutions is kind of a window into this bigger picture. Over the past, really since the mid-century, but really steeply in the past 20 years, we've seen a decline across the board for most of the major institutions, notably the government, all levels of the government, but other institutions as well. I mean, when we look at religion, for example, religious institutions were some of the most trusted in the country back in the 70s and 80s, and now they've fallen. So even in things where people historically have put a lot of their trust, that has eroded.
John, you look at the big national numbers when you ask Americans how things are going, and you say that in that once you do that, you see Muncie as a microcosm of a nation whose motto could be "In nothing we trust." Give us some of those polling numbers. I mean, we've heard them, but run us through again how Americans look at different institutions and the state of the nation.
Well, you start with the fact about 7 out of every 10 of us think the country's on the wrong track. About 8 in 10 are dissatisfied with the way the country is governed. Only 23% of the public has any confidence in banks. Just 19% have confidence in big business. Less than half of us have confidence in the public school system or organized religion. There's a sociologist who I talked to at Western New England University in Springfield, Laura Hansen, who put it really well. She said, we have lost our gods. She didn't mean that literally or spiritually. She meant that the institutions were the things that we looked up to and did protect, did seem to protect us, and we have lost them.
One of those basics was schools. What's going on with schools in Muncie?
In Muncie, they're like a lot of places around the country. They're suffering severe budget cuts, which is impacting the kind of services they can bring to students. For example, the superintendent there, Tim Heller, a really forward-thinking superintendent who's had success in other places in bringing technology to his school districts, can't get wireless service in his schools. He can't get laptops to his students like he's been able to in past places. Down the road, there's a charter school, which is quasi a public school. It's an alternative to the traditional public schools. And because of the way their funding mechanism is, they are fully wired and they do have laptops. And so you have a very steep decline in enrollment in the public schools in Muncie as more and more parents are going into charter schools and homeschooling their children. And again, those numbers translate very well nationally. The same thing is happening in every community in the country.
City politics, the kind of polarization and emotion that we've seen nationally, Muncie's also seen it.
Yeah, and it's, you know, one thing I didn't really get into in this piece was it's remarkable the similarities between what the country went through in 2000 with a contested election and a turning point in the hyper-partisanship that happened in the country in 2000. You can draw a dotted line to 2008 in Muncie when there was a contested election for mayor. A woman named Sharon McShirley became the first female mayor of the city and the first Republican in quite a while. She originally lost, and on a recount, contested recount, she won by just 13 votes. And the Democratic-controlled city council publicly stated that they were going to do everything they could to stop her in any way that they could. And it led to some very bitter meetings, very embarrassing meetings, and the kind of polarization that is now seen, you know, so much in
nationally.
Washington.
Right there in Middletown, USA, suddenly a YouTube sensation for a political meltdown. Ron Fournier and Sophie Quinton. Big piece in the National Journal is In Nothing We Trust. Listeners, you can join us. Is this you? Is this your town? 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about a portrait of Americans giving up on American institutions in one small city in Indiana. Talking about asking what it means for the country. Ron Fournier and Sophie Quinton are with us from the National Journal. They went back to Muncie, Indiana, famous from nearly a century of sociological studies. It's been dubbed Middletown, USA, a kind of national archetype. And they found deep disillusionment there. It is kind of a bummer of a story, though. They're finding citizens groping for ways forward as well. But this is not an easy situation that they describe. You can join the conversation in this hour. Is this you feeling failed on all sides by the institutions that should be there to make society work? Schools, banks, church, government. Does Muncie, Indiana sound like an aberration or like too often the way it is these days? And if these reporters came to your city or town, would things look better? What do you hear in the struggles of Muncie? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. President Obama was there back when he was running for president in 08, visited Muncie, tried to tap into that feeling of national malaise, of regular folk being failed by their government and more, and that got Johnny Whitmire's vote back then in 2008.
There are a whole bunch of folks in small towns in Pennsylvania, in towns right here in Indiana, in my hometown in Illinois, who are bitter. They are angry. They feel like they've been left behind. They feel like nobody's paying attention to what they're going through.
Candidate Barack Obama tapping into all that in 2008, and it is still out there to be tapped into. The reality brought to us in the National Journal here. Muncie, tell us what you think. 800-423-8255, Muncie, Indiana, of this depiction of your civic life. Let's get some listeners in right here. Kensington, Connecticut. John, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I grew up in the city next door. It's a small city, New Britain, hardware city of the world, home of Stanley Works, Fafner, Berry, Corbin Lock. They're all gone. I think we ought to take these small size cities and just split them up, end them, move the property lines, spread it out into six pieces to the neighboring communities, and try that as an experiment.
How does that help, John? I mean, you've still got the same people living there. You've got the same factories or no factories. How does it help to split them up?
You move the kids into better school systems. That starts it.
Redraw the lines. So you're thinking sort of geographically there, how we draw the lines around places and what kind of units might work? I've got it, John. Let us hold that. Stephanie in Nashville. Stephanie, thanks for calling.
Hi. I lived in Muncie for 10 years. I went to Ball State, and this isn't anything new. It was happening when I was a student there, and I think that the academia personnel that live there have let down the community just as much as everybody else.
How so?
They could be doing so much, and the students there are so insulated from what's going on in the rest of the community. They pretty much just stay on campus. They don't really go out anyplace else. And there's so much they could do as far as volunteering their time or even working in the school system. I mean, Ball State is the top teaching university in the state, and they could, you know, have more student teachers in the classrooms helping out to get more experience in the classrooms, but they don't.
Stephanie, you lived there for 10 years. Does this description of Muncie sound over the top to you, this kind of despair, at least in some quarters, this kind of disillusionment, or does it make sense to you?
No, it makes sense. And this was going on long before the recession hit. Many of the factories left Muncie when I was a student or before I got there in 96. So this isn't anything new. This has been going on in Muncie for a really long time.
Stephanie, I appreciate your call. And one more from Ann Arbor, Michigan. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I wanted to make two points that I think are relevant. One is, given the realities of peak oil, the difficulties that we're facing in this country are only going to get worse. Two, under our two-party system, which I think is badly broken, we're not going to get any better until we open up our political processes to third parties. And that is going to require voting reform, an issue that nobody is discussing. And the issue is, what changes can we make in our institutions, including our political institutions, so they serve us better?
What would a third party do that two aren't doing already, John?
Well, what they would do, Tom, is I think, as we saw in 92 when Ross Perot ran, they will discuss much more candidly the policy issues we face. We're getting simply pandering from both sides. They're not discussing, nobody's discussing the problems we face, the choices we face, and the things we need to do. I personally think that the idea that we're going to have to downsize the government, given the realities of peak oil, makes no sense. It means that we're going to have to tax more. It means, in my judgment, we'll probably have to spend more. But if we don't tackle that, we will not get a better future for our people.
John in Ann Arbor, I appreciate your call. Ron and Sophie, take us back to a little history here, and I'm not sure if it should bring us comfort or not. But when the Lynns, and this was a husband and wife team of sociologists that made Muncie famous in sociology circles in this country, when they went in the 1920s, they found a town that was then, nearly a century ago, struggling with change from agricultural to industrial economy, and things seemed to work out pretty well that time. So what can we learn from history here? Is this just cyclical?
You know, that's the question we try to get at. That's why we went to Muncie. They did famously describe Muncie at the time as a city and therefore illustrative of the country that had one foot in the 19th century in the agriculture era and another foot on an escalator, very fragilely placed, the way they put it, in the 20th century in the burgeoning industrial era. And they found at the time that people were being battered by unbridled commercialism, mm-hmm. that there was an incompetent, unhearing government, that they were being flustered by new technologies. In a lot of ways, it sounds like what we're going through today. And what they also found at the same time is during that period of incredible economic tumult, that transition from one economy to another, there was a big loss of faith in the institutions that had been the bulwark of the 19th century. What happened at that time period, as you know, is a lot of the institutions either adapted. For example, the way people connected back in the 19th century with one another and formed communities, barn raisings and knitting bees became irrelevant.
Those were going away. So what moved in?
What moved in within a very short period of time, 5 or 10 years, was all the fraternal organizations that are now kind of commonplace and actually since the 60s starting to die.
You mean like Knights of Columbus and Elks and Rotary and Moose and all that kind of stuff?
Exactly. Those fraternal organizations were unknown in the 1910s and 1920s, popped up out of nowhere, became the way that especially middle-class men came together for a good 2 or 3 decades. And as our institutions started declining in faith in the 1960s and 1970s, those fraternal organizations kind of were at the point of that negative spear. So Stephanie was exactly right. You look at Muncie today. which, by the way, is a great town. I go back there quite a bit for journalism and other purposes. It's not a town that I would want to portray in a negative light in any way, but it's very illustrative of what we're going through as a country. It is a city that on the north side of town, it is very globally connected, very socially connected, very much has made the transition to the 21st century.
North side as in university side.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's the Ball State University mm-hmm. side. The south side of town looks like my hometown, Detroit. Looks like Toledo. Empty factories. Men and women who were raised in an era and with the ethic that they could graduate from high school on Friday, start work on Monday in a factory, have a great pension, have a house, maybe a cottage with a boat, and have a have a good life in retirement. And they've been left behind. So it's a city, again, 100 years later, or 90 years since the Lens were there, that once again has its foot in one century, one foot in one century, and one in another. And they're having trouble with that transition. And again, like 90 years ago, the institutions are not helping them with that transition. So the question is, will the institutions that can adapt, will they die and be replaced? Will some institutions transition as happened 90 years ago? Or not. We saw some glimmers of hope in Muncie on this trip, but overall it was a pretty grim picture.
I mean, you're right. You know, what if this time institutions don't recover and our faith, as in sort of faith in the American promise, American dream, faith that everything can work, what if our faith dies with them? That's pretty dire. Sophie, how are people in Muncie coping? I mean, they're not just sitting there passively, presumably, or are they?
Right. Well, when we looked at the institutions that we really investigated, we did see examples of people trying to find a new way of doing things. I mean, when we looked at the religious institutions in town, we found two churches that were sort of very different. The mainline Methodist church was losing a lot of members. It was considered sort of stodgy and out of date. And just outside of downtown, there's a big mega church. And that is sort of a new way of organizing worship. It's bringing in a lot more people, but it also breaks them down into these little discussion groups where people can talk about things that are really relevant to their lives and pursue their own interests and sort of build these really tight-knit friendships. And we saw that as kind of the fact that people were leaving the mainline churches and heading to this big mega church was sort of showing that the big mega church was better suiting their needs. And when we looked at the school system in town, we found that a lot of parents were taking their kids out of the public schools and taking them to charter schools. And the charter school in Muncie is kind of an interesting model because it's partly virtual learning. So it's very plugged in, very high tech. There's a lot of online learning, a lot of educational software. And it was sort of parents just felt more connected to their child's progress through that model and through all the feedback that they were getting from all of this online education. So we sort of saw that technology in that institution was sort of allowing for some innovation and, for change.
So you've got old institutions, sometimes the mainline church there not doing so well, the Methodist church you look at, but then you look at a big church, Union Chapel, with counseling for depression, anxiety, eating disorders, marriage problems, alcoholism, sexual abuse, these sort of social club or discussion groups to give people connectivity. You've got charter schools emerging here as an alternative to public schools in trouble. Ron, do those look on balance like a kind of a adequate institutional response to fill the vacuum you describe?
Not yet. They certainly haven't crossed the bridge. But here's the reason for hope. Everyone you talk to in Muncie realizes there's a problem. Mm-hmm. And most of the people you're talking to are trying to find a way around it. You have people like the head librarian in Muncie who has started a new program called MAP that is trying to revitalize the city in the ways that City Hall can't. You have even the head of the mainline church and the head of the public schools both recognizing and talking very bluntly about what they could learn from the institutions that are thriving, how they could reform their institutions. And we do live in a period, Tom, as depressing as this is, we do have a lot more power as consumers than we ever did. When you think about, you know, what the power technology has given us to, tailor our shopping and to petition our government and to make changes online.
But that power doesn't necessarily empower our community. If we're buying on eBay or buying from somebody half a world away, it's not exactly boosting the corner store or necessarily the local economy.
It's not. But the only glimmer for hope is we've been through this 90 years ago when people had less power to affect change. And it took someone like, for example, in government, Teddy Roosevelt and the rest of the reformers to change government 90, 100 years ago. We have the ability to change things much quicker than we could 100 years ago. So it really is up to us. It's up to the people of Muncie. It's up to the people of America to realize it's not good enough just to say that I don't trust anybody. We have to blow the institutions up that aren't serving us, and we have to create new ones or force the older ones to adapt. And we do. This might be a very slender thread to hang on to, but we do have more power than we did 100 years ago. But it's up to us.
Boy, we're talking about Middletown, USA, Muncie, Indiana, and the mood that Ron Fournier and Sophie Quinton found there for the National Journal. It's right there in their headline: "In Nothing We Trust." I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's get a call from Texas. Marfa, Texas. Joe, thanks for calling. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think this is a very old issue. I mean, back in the 50s, when we had the issue of cultural divides, racially, culturally, financially, I would be interested to know in this study whether you have broken down the demographics of rich versus poor and racially motivated. I still believe that magnet schools favor Caucasian kids or whoever's in power in that economically. So that's my question.
It's great, Joe. Those are great questions. But let me put them to Ron and Sophie. What about cultural divides in Muncie, whether it's by income, rich, poor, as Joe says, or race? Do those factor in here?
Definitely, like it does in any community. There is one side of town is made up of people who have college degrees and are making above average salaries, and the other side of town are people, black and white, who don't have college degrees and are struggling to stay above the poverty line. One thing we did find, and Sophie was really key in digging this out and drawing a line beneath it, was that there is a general lack of faith in institutions in this country. But it is, as the caller suggested, more pronounced among people who are making less money and have less reason for hope.
So is there a leadership contingent in Muncie that's looking to pull things together and hammer out new ways? You know, where are the, I don't know, town fathers or town mothers here, Sophie?
Well, I think that absolutely is, as there is in any town. I mean, part of what we found interesting about Muncie is that we knew that we could tell a story here that we could really tell in any town across America. Ron, I don't know if when you were there you ran into anyone who was really working to pull things together or turn
things
around.
Yeah, I did. I mean, obviously I talked to the new mayor and the old mayor and the city council, but that's not where I really saw the action. It was talking to people like Virginia Niles, who's the head librarian and head of this new program called MAP. That is looking to restore, build the coalitions between the public and private sector to rebuild downtown and to improve the schools and to improve the environment and turn toxic land areas into new housing developments. I met a woman who runs something there called Teamwork, which is an anti-poverty program that links up middle-class Muncie volunteers with folks who are poor and surrounds the poor people with these volunteers who help them navigate the institutions and help them climb the ladder out of poverty. So there are real leaders and really, really good, solid people in Muncie who are making things happen. They're not necessarily on the ballot box, though.
But the impression you give overall in this story is that the weight of distrust and trouble is kind of overwhelming those efforts. I mean, you say it's not so clear that this time there'll be a cyclical recovery of institutions here.
That is, you know, the overwhelming feeling when you talk to people is, you know, how are we going to get out of this? But again, one thing we try to do here was not just stop at that, to look at the possible solutions and how people might be able to overcome this. But it's not going to be easy.
Ron Forney and Sophie Quinton with the National Journal, please stand by. We're looking this hour at a portrait of Americans kind of giving up on American institutions in one small city in Indiana and what that might mean for the country. Listeners, you can join us. Do we need some kind of top-to-bottom overhaul in this country to get our institutions straight? How do we do that? 800-423-TALK. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about a portrait of Americans giving up on American institutions in one small city in Indiana. And what that might mean for the country. Ron Fournier and Sophie Quinton with the National Journal out of Washington went to Muncie, Indiana, historically famous as Middletown, USA, from nearly a century of sociological research that's been done there. And they find it now a real hotbed of disillusionment. Their big headline is "In Nothing We Trust." You can read the article at our website, onpointradio.org. And it has raised a lot of buzz because people just don't want to see this as the heart of the country. But there's a lot of people resonating with what they're writing here about Muncie all over the country. You can join us this hour. What do you hear in the struggles of Muncie? And do we need some kind of top-to-bottom overhaul here? How do we do that with cool heads and fairness and intelligence and not a lot of money? What is driving the problem here? What will drive us out of it? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Ron, Sophie, we've got a lot of response online here. Here's one. Gail says, "I've lost faith in everything political, no faith in either party, and certainly none in Congress." Victor says, "This disconnect is a result of being told by your government, society, and media that you're on your own. No retirement, no medicine, no control over foreign aid and wars, no reciprocity for patriotism. Who wouldn't be disaffected and disappointed with what we have now?" Victor writes. And one more. Walk just says here, "This is the reason for the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street." Sort of bring it on attitude right there. Let's get up in arms a little. Let's go to Rochester, New York, and Bob, who's calling. Bob, thanks. You're on the air.
Tom, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to comment that this situation is nothing new. I live in a small town, primarily agricultural with some industrial, and I've been involved in virtually every aspect, whether it was community organizations, church, and an elected government official.
Yeah.
And frankly, apathy has been a problem now for at least 20 years. But my concern is that we've reached a tipping point, and the real factors are the departure of the manufacturing sector and the loss of any kind of good-paying jobs, and then the polarization in the politics. And I do agree with a previous caller that suggests maybe a third party helps. I'm a Republican, but frankly, I'm dismayed by the flow of attack ads and sound bites from both sides that mm-hmm. don't really seem to want to ever consider the idea of compromise. And that's my comment. Thank
you. Hey, Bob, before you go, do you see signs of some kind of grassroots response coming up? I mean, a century ago, it was a fraternal organization, you know, Elks and Moose and all that. Do you see the counterpart to that somehow coming up in your town?
No, in fact, I've been a member of the Lions Club for 25 years, and it's like pulling teeth to get members of the community, whether men or women, to join and participate in the things that we try to accomplish. And I'd say the same thing in terms of getting people to run for office or getting people to participate, whether it's in local politics or regional politics. It's virtually impossible to get people interested.
And Bob, I appreciate your call. Ron, Sophie, what about this? And where responsibility for this loss of faith goes? I mean, there's Bob. He's pointing down to ordinary citizens not doing their thing. I look around the web. It's interesting. Lots of response to your piece. And, you know, from left and right, I mean, townhall.com, conservative, you know, says, wow, this looks bad and scary, cancerous dysfunction of institutions. And they say we're caught in a downward spiral of dysfunction, disillusionment, and distrust. You've got Reason magazine here, libertarian, and they say, you know, it's just because you've got government that people can't get rid of. You need to adapt or improve or replace. You've got Slate, Alex Perrine writing here that this is basically a result of the financialization of our entire system of capitalism, the crippling of the labor movement. Do you draw sort of lines down to the roots of the problem, Ron, Sophie?
Well, I got to agree with Bob that he's right. This is not a new phenomenon. It really started to escalate in the 60s and 70s. But you do feel like there's a tipping point here. That's kind of what I thought intuitively going into writing the story, and certainly the reaction, as you say, from all sides of the political spectrum tells me that everyone just kind of feels like this is not sustainable. That how do you function as a society if the incentive to join it, to be a part of it, isn't there anymore? What happens to our country and our society if people start drawing more inward and don't want to be a part of government, don't want to be a part of, as he said, the Kiwanis Club or whatever the next iteration of that can be? It's a pretty scary prospect, and it's one we need to face because it's not a given that we're going to come out of it like we did 100 years ago.
But what do you mean the incentive's not there to be involved anymore? I mean, for heaven's sakes, the situation you're describing is so far from ideal, it looks like a pretty big incentive, community in trouble.
You would think, but if you don't trust if for example that you don't think you can have an impact on your city by running for city hall, you're not going to run for city hall. If you think that you can't have an impact on your community by joining or creating a new community program, or by helping out at your local church, you're not going to be helping your community. And if we all make that decision, if more of us make that decision than even now, where are we going to be as a society?
Boy, sooner or later, that doubles around on itself in a bad way, though. I mean, we live together. Max in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Max, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Tom, I was just wanting to say I went to Ball State myself. I grew in that area, grew up there.
Muncie, yeah.
Yeah, the reason I think Muncie's still struggling is because the people have gotten used to how things just are. But I think the people who should be responsible are, number one, the government. But also, I think Ball State, they're a great university. You know, they did a lot for me, but I think they need to step up because they got the people in the community. They have a great university. Education's the next step because there is a big disparity between the whites and the blacks there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, they need to improve the community, and they do need to give everybody the same fair opportunity.
Max, it's always true that stepping up wherever you are makes a huge difference. But what about the possibility that there are big structural changes around cities and towns like Muncie that make it hard to do that effectively?
Well, you know, I think Anderson is right next to Muncie, and they have a small Christian university there. But I think the competition between these two cities hurt Muncie because there's a small town between Anderson and Muncie. It's Yorktown. And I would say that's where a lot of the wealthy folks live. And, you know, it would be almost impossible to find a black person in Yorktown.
Mm-hmm.
Why that is, I don't know. I can't tell you the reason, but I think there's a lot that needs to be done. Obama was there, somebody said that earlier, and I went and listened to him, waited hours and hours. But I want to hear, what has he done for Muncie, you know, and what can he do? Factories, I don't think, are the answers anymore. We need to bring quality jobs because you got educated people. I graduated from there, and here I am in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Bowling Green and Muncie are almost the same size, but compare the economy in each city. Very, very, very different. Bowling Green is very successful. Somewhat low unemployment rate compared to surrounding areas.
Mm-hmm.
So they need to copy really what Bowling Green is doing. And I think that's what's needed to be done.
Max, it sounds like you're on it. I really appreciate your call, your wise eye there. Let me get one more here from Berea, Kentucky. John's calling. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I read the article the other day, and I sort of had a different approach to it, and I think the authors missed something. And with respect to the profile on Mr. Whitmire, and what I think they missed was Mr. Whitmire and his own personal responsibility for his situation, which was described, you know, in depth. I'm sort of an anachronism. I'm a liberal mortgage banker, and have been for 25 years.
Okay.
But what I saw in the article, what I pulled from that article, I'd be interested in some follow-up from the authors,
mm-hmm.
is that Mr. Whitmire bought a $40,000 house without putting any money down, telling me that he had no savings when, in his words, things had been going well for his family. He apparently had terrible credit, or at least bad credit.
So that puts a flag up in your mind as a mortgage lender. He bought the house, $40,000 house in 2000, no money down, $620 monthly mortgage payment. What about it, Ron? Sophie, was Johnny Whitmire setting himself up here when he did that?
There definitely is a personal responsibility element that has to go into any kind of story like this. For Johnny specifically, at the time he bought the house in 2000, he was working on a construction job. He got laid off earlier this year, shortly after his wife did, from that job. By the way, about 2 weeks ago, he was hired back.
Good.
So, you know, he's seen a lot of those comments. The caller is echoing what a lot of people have said online. And I asked Johnny about it. I called him up Monday night to check up on him. And he said, you know, what people have to understand is this wasn't a very big house. It's not a very fancy place. I work really hard. I do my 60, 70 hours a week. And
needed some place to live.
I thought that I could have a piece of the American dream. Yes, I didn't put money down, but I put money down on the front end. But every month I made my payment, and I did it for almost 11 years. And when I needed some help, I turned to the government. I turned to my mortgage lender, I was stiffed and wasn't really even given the information I needed to be able to come out from under this hole until it was too late. And then the salt in the wounds, a year later, he gets the bill from City Hall. So John, he certainly isn't a woe is me kind of guy. He does realize that he has some responsibility in this as well. But he just feels like he could use some help from the folks who are supposed to be working for him.
And when he thought he had it with a loan modification program, whacking the bill down from 620 to 473, and then they came back after 3 months and said, nope, not whacked down. Here's the back payment of $1,878, and that's the straw that broke the camel's back, the story out of Muncie.
And I've seen the paperwork. You know, there really wasn't much of an explanation. Now, Johnny is very appreciative of things like, for example, his congressman is Republican Mike Pence, who's running for governor there. His wife, who's partially disabled, was having some Social Security issues. And this is several months ago. They called Mike Pence's office. Mike Pence's office called the Social Security office, and they worked through those issues. There again is an example. You know, not everything's fallen apart. Things do work. There's an example where things work the way they should. But at the end of the day, now he's feeling burned. He's not an angry man. He's he's beaten up. He just feels like, you know, there's just nowhere to turn right now.
Carrying that outlook in Nothing We Trust. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's take a caller from Muncie, Indiana. Joey is calling from Muncie. Hi, Joey. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm pretty well. What do you think of all this, Joey?
Well, it's interesting to hear my hometown being talked about on a national scale. I've lived here primarily my whole life. I'm only 22. I moved here when I was 4. And really the biggest problem I've noticed is that the city itself doesn't really do much for its community. All our money is spent on vanity. We don't do anything to provide safe, fun things to do for college-age kids and children and their families, really. It's all bars. Our primary economy is bars and fast food restaurants. So those two are really your only major job options if you don't have a degree now. And because of that, we spend a lot of time arresting students for being drunk in public, and it just disenfranchises people with this town, and they don't want to stick around.
Hey, Joey, you sound like a relatively young man. Bars and fast food as the mainstays, as you see it. How do you look at the future? What's your level of hope, confidence, optimism, or not?
Well, I don't have much hope in this town. Really, every dime I get is spent as a means to maybe get out of here sometime. But what we need to do is just work together to be able to bring something worthwhile here.
We hear that. And Joey, we wish you luck with it there in Muncie, and we appreciate your call. Let me get one more, if I may, from Wakefield, Rhode Island. Abel's calling. Hi, Abel. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to speak, you know, briefly. I'm a community organizer here in Rhode Island, and I do see reason for
hope. You know, I work with politicians, and there can be a lot of dissatisfaction with the political process. I think we have the ability to sort of deal with that and get civic and have a rebirth there. But, you know, at the real local level, within our community, we pay a lot of emphasis on renewing the community garden movement, renewing local agriculture, really investing in local businesses. And, you know, we need to see those sort of basic grassroots growth happen at the local community level. And we need, you know, from my point of view, we really need people to get involved in the political process and have faith that they can have a voice.
Abel, do you see rebirth happening? Do you see it coming in your community? Do you see some hope there?
I do see hope, and I think, and I do think the Occupy and the Tea Party movements are both the stirrings of the American people in the political, you know, reactivation. We really need, like previous callers have said, third parties, independent candidates. You know, we need to prove that money does not rule our politics, and I think we can do that. We just have to have faith in ourselves and, you know, find those leaders that we need.
You're going to have to stand up pretty strong to make that point. It is no joke out there. I appreciate your call, Abel. Ron, here you are. You're editor-in-chief of the National Journal. You're looking at this and a lot more in the reportage coming out of your publication. I know you're going to look at solutions over the course of this year, but what do you see, broadly speaking? Where are you? What direction are you looking for solutions from Muncie and beyond?
Well, we are, like you say, we are spending a year looking into this. It's a package of stories in the magazine and online called Restoration Calls. And we're looking not just at the bad side of the coin, but, for example, the companion piece to this story that we'll be releasing online tomorrow looks at the fact that doctors are an institution that people trust more than they have in the past. And we look at why that might be at a time when all other institutions practically are looked at negatively. Why is it that people trust their personal doctor?
But they're in the middle of a health system that we've got huge problems with.
Right. But you know what? For whatever reason, they're not seen as part of that institution. What they are seen as somebody who will listen to me when I'm at my worst that I can be.
You're going to solve Muncie's problems with a stethoscope?
No, but there's something that can be said for the kind of real world person to person practical solutions that a doctor will give a person. It's something that we can learn from the rest of the institutions. And I think that the caller just now really touched on something. And in your question, the idea of looking at the grassroots. I mean, we are. The original institution in this country was the first family, and the first government was the first collection of families.
Well,
we are the institutions, and from the bottom up, we need to figure a way to reform these.
Sounds to me, reading your report out of Muncie, we're going to have to be just as ambitious and bold and brave as the folks a century ago, Teddy Roosevelt and the rest, who stood up and said, we want something different here, and they laid
exactly
down the tracks of institutions with a lot of sweat to make that happen. Ron Fournier and Sophie Quinton with the National Journal, authors of In Nothing We Trust. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.